thank you all for coming. And what we're going to do, I think I'm going to make some formal remarks. I'm not going to read from my book. You know, you don't want to hear me read. You can read yourself, can't you? Sure. But I'm going to make some formal remarks, and then we'll have questions and answers. And there's some rules for that. One is you don't have to just ask a question because it's not Jeopardy. You know, you can make a statement, but you can't make a speech. Okay. Also, you have to speak in a tone of voice that's suitable for a public gathering. You know, you're not on a telephone with me. These other people want to hear your question too. Okay. So, with that in mind, I'll just begin. How many of you are? Oh, and one other announcement. Nice people who run the Post Carbon Institute are here tonight. Just came in from England. Just flew in from England, and boy, are their arms tired. And they are here. They have some information that they'll make available at the signing table when we're done. And it's a very worthy organization that has been an umbrella group for understanding the predicament that we face and put together a tremendous amount of material, taped interviews, and other stuff. So how many of you are familiar with the global oil production peak issue? Virtually most of you, virtually all of you. So I'm not going to belabor that. I will perhaps introduce an idea that hasn't been really paid attention to. And that is really the amount of oil that's left in the United States. Just for your information, the amount of conventional crude oil left in the United States, we have 28 billion barrels of conventional crude oil left in the United States, according to the United States Department of Energy. We use 20 million barrels a day. That's 100 million barrels every 5 days. That's a billion barrels every 50 days, and there are about 7 periods of 50 in a year. So we're using about 7 billion barrels of oil a year. We have 28 billion barrels left. So do the math and just reflect on that and what it would mean if for some reason we were deprived of the oil that we get from people who don't like us. And think about that. The global energy predicament is going to change everything about how we live. And there are a couple of things that I've noticed lately that I want to bring to your attention. And I call them the psychological impediments that seem to now be embedded in our collective imaginations that do not enable us to think coherently about the problems that we face. And one of them I call the Jiminy Cricket Syndrome. And that's the idea that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. And that's mostly what we're doing, you know. And that comes pretty clearly from some things that that are self-evident about, you know, most of us have been bombarded by television commercials our entire lifetimes. And that's what that's all about, you know, wishing for things. It partly comes from the Spielberg movies. But wishing is not something I would want to deprive people of doing. I think it's important to wish. It's important to aspire to stuff and to want to accomplish things. But if all you're doing is wishing and not acting, that becomes a problem in your life individually and collectively as a culture. The second thing that is a big problem for us is what I call the Las Vegasization of the American mind. And that is sort of the source of that, or the essence of that, is the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. And that's a dangerous idea, especially for a culture, for a society, because it doesn't comport with reality, among other things. And it tends to defeat all earnest efforts to actually accomplish something or to face a problem and to do anything, to act. And you combine the Jiminy Cricket Syndrome and the Las Vegasization of the American mind, and you've got a real collective problem. And I think that's partly responsible for our inability to even have a coherent public discussion about this tremendous problem we face. Another question I think that is appropriate to ask is, where is the leadership on this issue. You know, we have no political leadership, business leadership, or and barely any science leadership on the issue of the global oil predicament. I think that there's another thing that's responsible for that politically. Politically, and in terms of business, we can explain it. You know, the dirty secret of the American economy for the last 20 years is that it's all about the creation of suburban sprawl. In other words, suburban houses, Mick houses, Mick strip malls, etc. The furnishing of suburban sprawl, the accessorizing of suburban sprawl, and the servicing of suburban sprawl. And if you subtract that from the economy, then there's not a whole lot left besides fried chicken and open heart surgery. And so our leaders are reluctant to broach the subject. And we saw this very clearly with Al Gore. You know, I had been and continue to be associated with the New Urbanist movement for the last 12 years. And I knew these guys personally, the founders of the organization, the Congress for the New Urbanism. And they were briefing Al Gore three times a year for 8 years. You know, and when the time came for him to run for president in 2000, he didn't touch this subject with a stick. Because he was afraid of offending that the home building industry, so-called, and indeed, the more than half of the American people who actually live in suburbia, he didn't want to diss them and their way of life. But the fact is, you know, whatever you think, it's kind of an interesting thing because for the last 10 years, there's been this idea that the only reason we have suburbia is because people like it, and it's good because people like it. It's, you know, what the Jesuits used to call casuistry. It's good because people like it. But I think the truth of the matter is that the suburban project can be described as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And that has led to yet another psychological impediment in our group thinking. And that is the psychology of previous investment. The psychology of previous investment. The idea that you've put so much, you've invested so much of your personal wealth and your collective wealth as a nation, as a state, or a municipality, or a community, you've invested so much of it in this infrastructure of daily living that you can't even imagine letting go of it or even reforming it. And so that prevents us from even thinking about what might happen, what might be the destiny of this way of life and all of the equipment that we've created to run it. Excuse me. I think that one of the chief characteristics of the suburban project for the last, you know, since the end of World War II is that it really has no future. And that's the fact that it has no future has been the reason that it lends itself to ridicule, because it's been one of the secret unarticulated agonies of the suburb is that it hasn't lived up to what it promised to be all these years. It's not country living. It's a cartoon of country living in a cartoon of the country in a cartoon of a country house. And it's not an accident that it all happened as television came into our lives and started to sort of hold our collective imagination hostage. And we're going to have to do something about this. And, you know, people sometimes complain that, I come in, blow into a town and do a talk and say, oh, you're so pessimistic. Can't you nourish us with solutions? Where are your solutions? And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't prescribe. You know, I can't give you 100 milligrams of alternative fuels. What I can do is give you, I think, a reasonable picture of what to expect and an idea of what a reasonable response to this predicament of the long emergency, as I call it, is going to be. And that response is that we are going to have to downscale and rescale and right-size and resize virtually all of the regular activities of our life and our culture. And that means we're going to have to reorganize agriculture, everyday commerce, schooling, the way we live in relation to each other, all of these things. It's a tremendous project. It's really the great task of our time. And we haven't even begun it. And one of the reasons, one of the reasons that we ought to be disappointed with the leadership is that there are some things we could have begun to do, and we haven't. You know, I didn't hear John Kerry say a word about restoring the passenger railroad system in this country. You know, nothing would do more quickly to make a difference in our petroleum use than if we restored the passenger rail system in this country. Wouldn't be a very difficult project to do. We don't have to reinvent the choo-choo train. The rights of way are all there still, waiting to be reoccupied. You know, some of them have been paved over for bike trails, but we can use them again and have bike trails next to them. We can do that. It's a project that America would help Americans to feel more confident about facing the future. And the fact that none of our political leaders has talked about it tells you how unserious we are. And this is not worthy behavior of political progressives. What passes for political progressivism right now in this country is fairly idiotic. If we look, for example, at the progressivism of the environmental movement, at Amory Lovin's Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory has been working on a hypercar for the last 12 years, a hypercar that will get phenomenal mileage and that will, you know, not use a lot of oil. And guess what the consequence of that is? Yeah, it promotes the idea that we can continue being a car-dependent country. What could be more a bigger waste of time? What could be more counterproductive? And yet, those are our leading environmental organizations. It's not worthy of us. We have to do better. Progressives have to do better. We have to ask our political leaders to do better. We have to, we have to be there when John Kerry or Al Gore or Hillary Clinton or whoever is there and say, why aren't you doing anything to restore the American passenger rail system, among other things? We're going to have to downscale, rescale everything. The cheese doodle and Pepsi-Cola formula for agriculture is not going to be working very well for us into the 21st century. We're probably going to have to grow more of our food closer to home. And there are tremendous implications for this. Implications even for people like the promoters of alternative fuels. And I had a kind of a wrestling match a few weeks ago by email with the biodiesel enthusiasts. They were ticked off at me because I dissed them at a college lecture in Middlebury. And they couldn't believe it. Why are you against us, dude? I'm not against them, really, but when I started to explore the subject with them and realized what they weren't paying attention to, basically the idea is we're going to devote a lot of cropland to growing these vegetable oil-producing plants, and then we're going to run the interstate highway system on it, right? Okay. So I said, are you guys aware that industrial agriculture is probably not going to be doing too well in 20 years? And they said, well, yeah, sort of, dude. And I said, well, one of the consequences of that is we're probably going to have to devote more cropland to growing crops for human beings because our crop yields will go way down when we're not pouring oil and natural gas on the soil to grow corn for a Cargill. And they said, they're not thinking about it. We're probably going to be using more working animals. And I don't know how many more, maybe 2%, maybe 5%, maybe 7%, maybe 20%. We don't know. But they require a lot of acreage. You have to grow food for them, too. So, I don't think we're thinking through the consequences of this. One of the consequences of the long emergency, it's a rather unappetizing thing. There are going to be a lot of losers produced by this period of history, a lot of economic losers. They're going to be very angry. They're going to be full of grievance and resentment. They're going to be bewildered about the loss of their entitlements to the American dream, to the promise of the drive-in utopia will be withdrawn from them and all of its perks. and they'll be ticked off. Many of them may end up working in agriculture, you know? They may, because we're going to have to grow more food locally, and it is probably going to have to be more labor-intensive. You know, we're going to have the return of a class of people we haven't seen in this country for a long time. Native-born, agricultural, laborers, and workers of different kinds. And we really we can't predict what the social relations are going to be between those workers and those disappointed, formerly middle-class people. That's the name of this new group of people, the formerly middle class. And we don't know what the social relations are going to be between them and the people who own the land, and whether they'll continue to be able to own the land, because that's generally, historically, a recipe for a lot of social unrest and even revolution. And America is not so exceptional that we're immune to the tides of history. But, you know, the Jiminy Cricket syndrome and the idea that you can get something for nothing has been very disruptive and made it really impossible for us to think straight. No combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them is going to allow us to run Walt Disney World, the interstate highway system, and America really as we're accustomed to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it. Not even a substantial fraction, not yet. There's not going to be a hydrogen economy. You know, as it has been sold to the American people, it's simply a hoax. And some of you may understand, you know, the technical reasons for that. There are many reasons, chemical reasons, scientific reasons why it is unlikely to happen. We are going to do wind. We are going to do solar. And they're going to be important. But we're probably not going to run the interstate highway system in Disney World on them. They will probably tend to be local. They will probably tend to be used on the neighborhood and even individual basis. And that, too, you know, raises very troubling questions, political questions. Will the people who don't have turbines and solar arrays, will they be full of grievance against the people who do have them, the people who can generate electricity? You know, will they... will they be fighting with them or in conflict with them? My own opinion is that the formerly middle class, you know, NASCAR Nation meets the Weimar Republic, is going to be so ticked off that they're going to vote for cornpone Nazis to make America like it was in 1997. Now, that's only my opinion, but I think it's something that we ought to be. You know, a lot of my friends are wringing their hands about George Bush. Oh, he's like Big Brother. Oh, he's so terrible. You know, I didn't vote for him, and you know, I'm not necessarily a supporter of him. But I think that we could do a lot worse, and I think that, you know, you may be shocked to find that we can do a lot worse than George Bush. I happen to think also that anything that is anything that occurs at the gigantic scale of operation is going to tend to not work very well in the long emergency. You know, whether it's giant corporations that rely on 12,000-mile merchandise supply lines and the warehouse on wheels that, you know, continuously runs on gasoline, or whether it's a big farm, a corporate Archer Daniel Midland, you know, 5,000-acre corn operation, or whether, indeed, even a centralized high school, and government. And so my friends and cohorts are wringing their hands over George Bush. You know, I think that we'll be lucky if the federal government can answer the phones, let alone regulate your life in the years ahead. You know, the politics that we really are probably going to have to be concerned about are the politics at the local and the regional level, because that's where the action is going to be. We are going to have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency that were systematically destroyed by the locust plague, the swarm organism of Walmart and Target and the national chain retail stores. And by the way, the American people were fully complicit in the destruction of their towns. They weren't passive victims. And I've been involved in many a Walmart battle over the United States, and every one of those battles has a contingent of local people who want Walmart. You know, they want bargain shopping. They want to save $7 on a hairdryer, and they don't care if they throw out $600,000 or $6 million of their civic life and civic amenity to save those $7. We're going to have to reorganize those local networks. It is going to be very difficult. It's going to be a tremendous assignment for us. And, of course, we're going to have to make some big changes in how we live and where we live. I tend to think that the smaller towns and the smaller cities are going to do better than the larger cities. I think that the larger cities are exactly what they seem to be. They are products of the hypertrophy of the 20th century, fed by the nutrient medium of cheap oil. And the cities tend to be overburdened with mega structures and skyscrapers and things that we really don't know whether we can run these things. Skyscrapers and mega structures, even 10-story apartment buildings, are experimental building forms that have only been with us in the fossil fuel age. And we have to be particularly concerned about the depletion of natural gas. Because that's how many of our megastructures are heated in that part of the country where that's necessary. And, you know, you can't have space heating in a 12-story or 30-story apartment building. You can't just heat a few rooms, stay warm there, because the whole idea of modern plumbing depends on being able to heat an entire building. You know, if it's 30 degrees in one part of the building and the pipes burst, that's pretty much it for the whole building. So, you know... many of our cities, by the way, and this is self-evident, are in an advanced state of decomposition already. You know, if you go around the country as I do, and you see places like Kansas City and Detroit and St. Louis and Milwaukee, you know, you see what has happened to our cities. The geopolitics that we face are also daunting. There are some people who seem to have gotten the idea lately that I'm a supporter, that I'm a cheerleader for the Iraq war. And I don't think that's true. I've been trying to describe what I think the Iraq war is, but that's not the same as being a cheerleader. I'll try to describe it here again. It's a desperate attempt on the part of our country, our leaders, to stabilize a part of the world where two-thirds of the remaining oil is. In effect, we opened a police station in Iraq, and we opened it there because it was the best candidate for that police station. It had a leader who was widely regarded as a maniac, even by people who don't like us, who was widely disliked. And for whatever reasons, that was our selection for the siting our police station. Secondarily, we embarked on the Iraq adventure in order to modify and influence the behavior of two important neighbors, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And that's what it was about. The real question is, how long can we remain there? How long can we occupy unfriendly countries? And how much unfriendlier will they become while we're occupying them? And how many can we occupy at a time if we have to? And I think that that is a project that we can't feel confident about. Sooner or later, we're going to have to not be there anymore. And whether it's 18 months or 3 years or 6 years or, you know, you pick the figure. Whatever it is, isn't really a long time. And what happens when we withdraw? And also, to step back a little bit, how much of a state of exhaustion and bankruptcy will we find ourselves in as that occurs? Because that will happen to us. You know, as incrementally we lose American soldiers' lives a week, you know, every week, grinding on 52 weeks a year for 36 months, 6 years, whatever it is. That will be a process of attrition. So sooner or later we may face the prospect of withdrawing from the Middle East and not facing the prospect of not being able to control those unfriendly nations. What happens then? Do we lose our access to that oil, to even being able to buy it? Maybe. Maybe. And what happens when that what happens then when we are back with our 28 billion barrels or maybe 24 billion or maybe 19 billion barrels of conventional crude oil that we have left, that we're still burning at the rate of $7 billion a year? Because I'll tell you something else. The people in Dallas and Atlanta and Houston and Northern Virginia and Southern California and Washington State are not going to stop driving. They're not going to stop making those 60-mile-a-day commutes, you know, unless they lose their jobs and they don't have to do it anymore. And then we'll be faced with the prospect of a lot of economic losers, and that's not a happy prospect either. I have friends in back where I come from in upstate New York who are, you know, very anti-war. I have to ask them politely to take the bumper stickers off their SUVs that say "War is not the answer." Some of them I've actually, you know, I had to come out and say, by the way, war is the answer. It's the answer for you. Get used to it. What happens with China? China, you know, 2/3 of the remaining oil is in the Middle East, and another substantial portion of it is in Central Asia, in particular the former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan. China can walk into Kazakhstan if they want, and they may, because they're more desperate for oil, arguably, than we are. They actually have less of it, and they are still undergoing economic growth in the conventional sense of the industrial sense of it. Are we going to have a land war with China in Asia? That's not a project we can feel confident about. So, you know, these things have tremendous implications for us, and I think that the only thing that we reasonably can do is prepare to live differently in this country. We have traditionally been a brave people and a generous people and an earnest, hardworking people who did not expect to get something for nothing, you know, who did not believe that life was just a matter of buying lottery tickets. We actually had to act and do things and make things happen. And for a couple of decades now, I think we've sort of lost that. But it doesn't mean we can't recover it, and I think we may. I'm actually not pessimistic. I'm actually a rather hopeful, cheerful person. I think that there will be many benefits to the hardships that we face. And it may allow us to become a more serious people again and a people who are engaged in work that is meaningful with other people who are close to us in communities that are meaningful to us. And we will not be expending all of our spiritual energy sustaining a set of ideas that are only pernicious and ultimately militate against everything that evinces living in life, you know, and not being caught up in what has really become a culture of death apart from even the question of war. That's it. I want to thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to stick around and be available signing books up here. And thank you very much for coming.